Hello and welcome to Viking Age Environments. I'm Rebecca Boyd and today I'm talking to Rowan Jackson. Rowan is a university teacher in the University of Edinburgh, where he completed his PhD on environmental adaptation and climate change in the Norse North Atlantic. His research specifically focused on Greenland, and that's what we'll be talking about today. Rowan is currently a postdoctoral research assistant on a project looking at the impacts of climate change in sunnier climates than Greenland in South Africa, Sri Lanka, and Indonesia. He also teaches on the Environmental Sustainability Master's Programme in Edinburgh. One of Rowan's other research questions is the usefulness and the application of archaeology to contemporary environmental and climate challenges. We'll talk towards the end of the podcast about Rowan's work on global change research and the contributions that archaeology can make to programmes like this. We start off by talking about the Norse arrival in Greenland, the underlying conditions that led to this movement of people from Scandinavia through Iceland out to Greenland. Rowan tells us about the toolkit that they brought with them, the Viking way of farming that they initially brought to Greenland and adapted to deal with and to survive in the harsh climate there. We talk about that initial process of adaptation, and Rowan explains to us what the concept of landscape learning is. We'll also talk about the roles of gender and childhood in Greenland, specifically looking at how and where children learned to be Viking, learned to be part of the Norse North Atlantic. And then we move on to talking about what happens in the 15th century, about the intense climatic change, about the ways that people experienced that change, and about the processes of adaptation that ultimately failed, and the end of the Norse North Atlantic experience. I start off by asking Rowan a very difficult question to begin the interview.
What makes you qualified to talk about climate change in the North Atlantic, in the Norse North Atlantic? Why should we listen to you talking about this?
I suppose that's quite a challenging question. Yeah, when it comes to someone who's, I suppose, sitting in quite an interdisciplinary position and potentially, I wouldn't necessarily define myself as a specialist in any of the sort of key branches of the sort of analysing the data sets that we get from the North Atlantic. We've got a lot of colleagues at City University of New York who look at zooarchaeology, for example. And then, of course, there's the paleoclimatologists and the paleoecologists, and we use all of that data together, of course, to reconstruct what happened within in Norse Greenland settlement, and of course also the other settlements across the North Atlantic, which you can't really look at Greenland in isolation without also looking at Thule sites towards the end of the Norse settlement in Greenland. And also, the associated Viking Age sites in Iceland, Newfoundland, all of these other locations in the North Atlantic. So I suppose I sit at the intersection between all of these different research traditions and these different specialist research areas. And I suppose I've seen my position as being someone who can synthesize and look at the bigger picture when looking into the past, but then also looking not just at understanding what happened in North Greenland, but also understanding the relevance of that and trying to cut through some of the challenges of interpreting what happened in North Greenland and its relevance to the present day. Things like the Diamond-esque narratives present, where we're speaking to policymakers and looking at how is archaeological and historical information actually relevant. We're finding that the Diamond-esque narrative is still dominant among policymakers and practitioners because it has been so influential. And I suppose we'll get onto this later, but the real point is that there's been a lot of diamond bashing, but I think there's a nice balance that can be struck from taking quite a broad interdisciplinary perspective of looking at what Diamond has said. He's also a geographer. Mm-hmm. Comes from a very different approach to my background, so he's more inclined, I think, to go for a deterministic and reduction, a sort of reductive approach to looking at the past. But I think my background in geography, in both looking at human and physical geography, allows me at least some perspective on looking at how to bring in human agency and how to interpret different forms of adaptive strategy while working with archaeologists, historians, paleoecologists and paleoclimatologists.
Okay, so great.
That's my position. So non-specialist, but gets involved.
Yeah, but that's a really valuable position to have as well, though, because, it means that you have the oversight, you can see what everybody is doing and put it together. And I think that's what we need to do. And that's where we need to be. We need to be looking for the big picture to make ourselves relevant and to make this data relevant, to make it appealing. To me, archaeology is about stories, about telling the stories of the people who are here before us. But what makes us really valuable is the way we frame those stories to tell the narrative that we need. And the narrative of climate change and of adaptation and resilience is really, really important. The fact that we've been here before, we've done things like this before, the earth that we are, that we can adapt, that we can change our behaviour and we can influence things in a positive way. We need to show that is ongoing and has been throughout the past.
And I find I've also found the work by Alison Wiley and Gavin Lucas on how we take these strands of evidence and how we either articulate the archaeological record or how reading the archaeological record is about taking the record itself. It's not necessarily the act of excavation and analysis as much as reinterpretation of data over and over again. So I've been very interested in how to reanalyze data, mm-hmm. and how archaeology by its nature offers data sets, even in the papers, even in reading academic papers where it's often been hidden, especially in the geosciences where all of the coding's often hidden. There's been a move towards trying to make that more visible and sharing code, but a lot of the process is often hidden. I think with archaeology, there's a really interesting move towards really understanding how you can read a paper and you can start to go back to the elements that bring about forms of interpretation and forms of sense.
No, it does. And that's exactly it. It's reanalyzing. And the other perspective is that archaeology is a finite resource. We are eventually going to run out of things to dig up. So we have to first of all make sure that we leave sites to be excavated, that we don't dig everything up, and that we go back over the archives that we have and make sure that we get full value of them, and full analysis and reanalysis. Sites that were excavated even 20 years ago, we can look in a completely different way at now, never mind the sites that were excavated 50 or 100 years ago.
And
it's really valuable to do that.
I think that, and that's a good point. I suppose it becomes interrelated within the climate crisis at present, especially in the Arctic, where it would be nice if we didn't have to dig up records as fast as possible. Thawing permafrost, of course, is destroying
the fact of the matter.
The record, I suppose we can talk about that more later.
Okay, so let's move on and let's talk about Greenland for a little while. So could you start by telling me what happens in Greenland? So when our first Vikings arrive there, what do they find?
So I suppose just to rewind so slightly. So one of the big questions over the last 10 years has been, going back to assumptions as to why the Norse occupied the North Atlantic. Why would they move? Of course, first from West Norway, and then from the the Northern Isles of Scotland, the Faroe Islands, then across to Iceland and Greenland. And one of the big questions asked by Christian Keller about 11 years ago now was, you know, why would the Norse occupy a site on the edge of the known world when there is potentially there's potentially still space for them to occupy land across the rest of the North Atlantic, but also Europe. And of course, there is the push factor of the sort of political centralization at the time in West Norway, and the sort of threat to a number of the existing landowning elite groups, if you'd like to refer to them in those terms, of the chieftains. And then also this idea very recently that it could be about Viking sex ratios and also about, you know, a young group of people trying to find land in order to establish an economic base, but also establish a name for themselves in the North Atlantic. So there's opportunities there, but there's also the economic pull as well, as soon as you get into the North Atlantic. And one of the ideas that has been discussed is the idea that that you have these sort of hunting expeditions where they'll go out, explore the environment, get an idea of the resources, and then go back, and that's then the part of the pull to those areas. And war of ivory in the last 6 years has been a big focus among some of the zoo archaeologists and geneticists and other groups within particularly Denmark and New York, those groups. So I'd say that the big pull to Greenland is the potential extirpation of the walrus populations in Iceland. And there are a series of recent papers on that subject with that increasing pull. So they move across arguably for the availability of land close to these walrus populations in the Disko Bay area. And this also coincides with a period of relatively mild climate. And you know, from that, we'd assume better sailing conditions to move across the North Atlantic. So, of course, you get the Eric the Red narrative where in 985, you get a series of boats going across there and occupying the eastern settlement area and then also the western settlement. So the eastern settlement is actually on the west side of the southern peninsula of Greenland, of course. And then the western settlement is a few hundred miles further north in the modern-day Nuuk area. So they established settlement there. And there was previously an idea that peak settlement, which you reach around 1300, comprised around, across both settlement areas, around 6,000 people. Those have recently been revised because one of our colleagues in Greenland, at the National Museum in Greenland, Christine Madsen, has done some very extensive survey work in the Vatnajökull area of eastern settlement, which has shown that the occupied farms at any one point in time is more likely to suggest a population of around 2,200 population across both settlement areas if you aggregate the results of that survey work and the radiocarbon dates we've had from those sites. So that suggests that the likes of Christian Keller, who's done a lot of the analysis of skeletal remains from church burials, his demographic analysis is correct in suggesting it. Well, at least it corroborates his evidence in suggesting that a peak population of 2,200 is what we get. And the reason I mentioned that early on is because when you're talking about the relevance of Greenland, we're talking about, you know, a population across two very large areas, in the eastern and western settlements, of less than a small village in Britain or Ireland, you know. So
it's not a lot of people.
It's not a lot of people with which to sort of start to make any suggestions of archaeological relevance. But I suppose we can get onto that later once sort of been through the narrative a bit more. But if I push on a bit more, so what you get is, so around 1300, you reach this, at least it's projected that you reach this peak settlement in Greenland. That's from Niels Linnerup's demographic analysis. And afterwards, you would start to get a decline. And that's the point at which there's this great level of uncertainty. So around 1300, you'd assume you'd get peak settlement because actually the climate is still relatively mild. The Norse have brought over this, you could call it a Viking toolkit of animal husbandry and some cereal cultivation. There's some evidence to suggest they did attempt some early cereal cultivation in eastern and western settlements, things like barley found on some of the sites in the eastern settlements at least. But it's right at the edge of the cereal line, and it's unlikely that they were able to cultivate much at all, if anything, really, other than just adopting animal husbandry. And then even animal husbandry, so the normal assemblage that they would bring across of cattle and caprines, so sheep and goats, as well as pigs and some other associated animals, such as small sort of the cute Icelandic horses that you would see. if you go across to if you go across to Greenland now, you can see people still using those quite small horses.
So they brought that
across, and you initially see from some of the sites that these early assemblages are quite similar to what you'd see in West Norway, and also early settlements in Iceland, but they're subsequently refined due to this sort of the length of the winter season, the period at which you don't have to store winter fodder and keep them in those winter months. So you start to see more of an emphasis on the hardier species, such as goats, a relative decline in the number of cattle. We previously thought that they phased out pigs, but some of the recent results from Konrad Smirowski's zooarchaeological analysis, particularly in the eastern settlement, reveal that they do seem to maintain pigs, but pigs were phased out in places like, or at least they were limited in places like at the Faroe Islands, because they eat a lot of roots and they uproot the only trees that you might, the only dwarf shrubs and trees that you might have in
that. That they were, not the best animal then.
So I suppose that was a long-winded way of saying that they do refine what they bring with them in their domestic assemblages, and then on top of that they also adopt hunting strategies to supplement the shortfalls of their domestic economy. Mm-hmm. So they hunt seals on the outer fjords, and they set up hunting stations. There's been some a couple of recent publications on the use of these hunting stations by the Norse settlers, and the establishment of different shealings as hunting stations in marine environments. All of the evidence is suggesting that the Norse adapt really well in Greenland, especially up to that point around 1300.
Yeah.
Towards 1400, at which point you start to see decline.
So is that the process of landscape learning that you called it?
So
is that where that fits in? That period of bringing in what you have and then gradually adapting it to what's there, what's suitable, what works and what doesn't?
So this is something that Marty Rockman wrote about back in 2003, and it's certainly relevant in the context of the Norse arriving in a landscape that is, at least to them, culturally blank. You did have evidence of cultural presence within those landscapes beforehand. And actually within the Icelandic annals, there are some records of stone tools. They refer to finding stone tools within the settlement areas. But for all intents and purposes, they don't know how to utilise the resources in the landscape, so that would require landscape learning. So there's first of all occasional learning, where you go across the landscape and identify critical resources. So that could be identifying those key resources, such as seals, such as caribou, especially in the Western settlements, those initial, if there were initial scouting parties to go out to find walrus populations and other Arctic exotica, such as narwhal. So identifying the species within the range of those settlements. And then on top of that, there's timing. So the next element of landscape learning would be to establish, you know, what you can do with a given labour force. So that's where the population starts to become very important. If you've got such a small population and you're doing communal hunting as well as maintaining the domestic economy, then there's only a finite spread of that resource throughout the landscape to fulfill all of those different activities. So it's important that you get those right. And then on top of that, there's this sort of social category beyond that. That's what's discussed within the literature, of trying to adopt this within within the sort of general norms and existing sort of cultural limits of, you know, of what the Norse knew how, what the Norse bring along with them as a sort of adaptive toolkit, but also what they what would fit in with their existing way of life.
Mm-hmm. What they, the way they already know how to live, how to work the land. What they expect to do when they arrive there, and then the reality sets in.
So some of the early work in what has since been defined as sort of modern archaeology in Greenland, which is from 1976 onwards. That's when the National Museum start to do international archaeological research together with collaborators in the US. From that period onwards, there was more of an emphasis on looking for those elements of what has subsequently been termed landscape learning, where they were looking at the seasonal rounds and they were looking at what you could do within the active year. So the active year in Greenland is fairly short. You know, you're looking at the sort of height of the active season is less than 6 months. So you've got a very long period at which you have to look after your domestic livestock. Then a short period in which you have to, you know, go through that process of transhumance, where you're moving the livestock away from the sort of nucleus of the settlement area out into the wider landscape. So that's labour intensive. You've then got the sealing season, so going to catch a migratory harp seal. We come around the southern tip of Greenland and get back to the inner, you know, storing those the meat from that. And then there's also the northern hunting, so taking parties up to the northern hunting grounds to primarily extract this walrus ivory for trade on the prestigious European markets, and also becomes part of the royal tax to the King of Norway. So there's all of this to balance before you even get to the hay season, where you have to collect all of the hay and then bring all the livestock back in. So there's a very intense active season. And what I discussed within the human ecology paper is sort of using some of this more recent data, some of this recent information that we've gathered from archaeological, paleoecological and climatological research is that the seasonal round would, of course, would be squeezed increasingly as it started to get cold. If you get more the presence of summer sea ice, which is inferred from a number of sort of sediment cores and diatom analysis within eastern settlement, shows that you get increasing summer sea ice from around 1400 onwards, especially. So it starts to become increasingly difficult, and those initial adaptive strategies that they employ that work very well start to become squeezed increasingly as a result of that.
One point that you made that was just something that I'd never thought about was, you know, if there's physically more water in the ground, you know, it takes longer for that ground to thaw every spring, and that consequently, you know, you can't you're not sowing crops, so are you? But the grass takes longer has a shorter time to grow. It comes up later in the season. And that gets squeezed. It's just something I hadn't thought of.
And there's been some analysis of this by Laura Comey, who was previously here in Edinburgh Geosciences, where she looked at the presence of sort of snow on the outfields or even on the infields, and the amount of time it might have taken for that to thaw out.
Yeah.
And of course, you then got the frozen ground itself, which limits the growth
underneath the snow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah.
So it becomes incredibly difficult, and this is where it becomes a matter of balancing existing sort of environmental determinism with what we knew the Norse had the capacity to do, and what recent evidence shows they had the capacity to utilize as a response to environmental change. Mm-hmm. One of the other things, we only mentioned it briefly, but some of the analysis that environmental scientists have done recently is to say that if you also employ manuring as a strategy to try and boost the sort of fodder yield from the inner fields that they'd use for fodder cultivation, that would have an even more detrimental effect, because you have even more water content within the soil, which would freeze over at a higher temperature as well. So it's strategies also start to become potentially mismatched with the environmental context. So if that environmental knowledge was transmitted onwards, and if they did gather environmental knowledge from previous environments, at the extreme, certain strategies will start to become maladaptive.
So what you're coming towards there is the idea of the transmission to the traditional ecological knowledge, the passing down of knowledge. So you're talking about it coming from region to region, as well as through time, over generations, through the family, through the household. When granddad was back in Norway, he used to do this, and then dad in Iceland tried this. So now we're here, we're going to do what dad did in Iceland because it worked there, so it should work here. But then three generations down the line, it's not working, and they have to change again.
Yeah, yeah, and of course, I mean, it should be noted that there are big gaps in the record that we have. So a lot of this is about setting hypotheses that we'd like to test in the future, and if data permits, we'll be able to test. But the idea is that this has been discussed in existing literatures as well, is that because the Norse, in effect, attempts to establish a similar cultural landscape, and they. They find landscapes that are potentially similar to what you'd see in northern Scotland and Iceland and the Faroe Islands, that you've got this knowledge that you've gathered as well as to how to act within that environment. So that's important knowledge. So you might get knowledge of how to utilise seabird populations and the existing knowledge they have of how to hunt seals with netting and clubbing strategies, where they go out in boats and they'll gather them onshore with nets and then club them. The challenge would be, if you have that existing knowledge and you bring that knowledge together with that sort of technological knowledge to a new environment, it might work for a certain amount of time, especially in a mild period. But if you get more sea ice and you get a new a new ecological niche for seal species as well, it starts to test the extent to which those strategies are either efficient, but it can also can also be utilized practically or in a way that's not dangerous as well. So with the sea ice, that's obviously a problem for open water and therefore gathering these seals, but it also brings in a new niche for ice riding seals, where the adaptive toolkit is very much more associated with individual hunters and the Thule culture, and what they bring with them, with harpoon technologies and kayaks, in which they're able to move around that marine environment with a higher degree of efficiency. So that's the way we've been thinking about this over technically, if you think back to the 1980s, Tom McGovern's been looking at this and looking at the role of Norse hunters within that environment, and what happens when they come into contact with a new new culture. And there's been recent work, you know, back in the 1990s, then the early 2000s, about the timing and the relationship between the Norse and other Arctic cultures. That are inferred in the saga texts as well. So it starts to become quite a complex, you know, somewhat speculative exercise in trying to understand the connection between these different records that we have and the timing and what radiocarbon dates seem to suggest, you know, whether there's overlap or not, or there's contact between different groups.
So, yeah, so that brings us into the idea that there are other cultural groups already there. There are the Inuit populations. And what struck me was the way you described their very different cultural niche, that all their learning happens in the environment, in the landscape, whereas the Norse learning happens at home. You know, everyone in the winter, people are at home in the house, around the summer on the farm, and it's very much within that defined environment, that comes into, you know, my own work on houses, on the Viking house. You know, the house is where you are, the house is everything. Whereas the Inuit learning happens everywhere and all the time, and you know, that there's the constant adaptation and constant awareness of the environment, of what is there, and that when these two cultures meet, and then when the climate changes in after the 13th century, then this is when this disequilibrium begins to really, really set in.
Yeah, yeah, and that's I suppose that's where we go from this transition from. I suppose it's the question of continuity and change. So if we think of the Norse culture, together with, you know, cultural transmission is very important at creating this collection of knowledge, this collective mm-hmm. knowledge that is still adaptive. So in theory, if you have perfect knowledge, you discard knowledge that's no longer useful in that environmental context. And you would maintain adaptive knowledges. But of course, it doesn't work like that. You do get some path dependency. And of course, it's more than just saying what's adaptive. We can't just talk about this sort of perfect equilibrium between the environment and culture. Culture has to come in there, and culture allows obviously people to make decisions aside from just environmental change. So we need to think about path dependency on the one hand, and then also the capacity for social learning. So that's what I was thinking of in the context of looking at the Norse and the Thule cultures, cultural niches. So there's been existing work on childhood in the Thule culture by Robert Park, thinking about how children grow up in these Arctic and subarctic environments. But there's also quite a rich ethnographic record from the late 19th and early 20th centuries, from people like Knud Rasmussen and other people who were involved in the Thule expedition. And what that seems to show is a strong awareness of the wider environment, and a push for children to explore the wider environment and to learn for themselves, and also different forms of a sort of pedagogy, if you want to think of it in those terms, how to relate to the environment, how to learn. So what I could see from the evidence, or at least the way I interpreted the evidence, was that the Thule culture are very much about experimentation out in the environment, whereas the Norse seems to, although I'm not saying they didn't experiment, there seems to be more play culture around key sort of iconic objects within the Norse records. So you get toy boats, what I've interpreted as a toy axe. There's debate over whether it's a toy axe or not, which is a whalebone axe that was from the Eastern Settlement. I know it was the Western Settlement. Anyway, that's but you find all these artifacts that you know, are balanced with what we might consider these ideas of hegemonic masculinity among male children, and then also, you know, preparatory home, you know, homestead and miniatures, the sorts of things that, you know, that utilize around the home environment. So playing with toy horses and, you know, all of those other different animals that you find within the domestic landscape. So there are lots of objects that seem to suggest that they socialized in those respects, and mm-hmm. they learn how to navigate that cultural landscape. It's not to say that, of course, they don't also learn about other animals within the wider environment, but the evidence from ethnographic records and archaeological records among the Thule culture suggests that they have a large number of miniatures. You get a large number of child miniatures that are associated with the adult material culture. And this seems to fit in with the ethnographic evidence of children playing and becoming very accustomed with adult material cultures around hunting and mm-hmm. how to make that connection between the technology and the wider environment. So that's what I looked at partly in this paper and in a chapter of my PhD, was to look at, you know, how would child social learning in those formative years influence the degree of path dependency that we see in these two separate cultures. The indication is that the Thule culture seem to refine their technologies quite a bit to, you know, in context with the environment. There's a large degree of learning in those sort of adolescent and pre-adolescent years. I'm sure the Norse did as well, but we have less evidence that they refine their technologies, and there's no evidence that they ever took on any Arctic hunting technologies or anything like that.
Yeah.
So the suggestion is there's a higher degree of path dependence in the Norse sort of model of social learning and cultural transmission of knowledge.
I'm really fascinated by this idea, and then of course I'm immediately wondering, how do we apply that to children living in towns, you know, where you're going from this isolated farmstead model, because that was the model in Ireland as well, you know, that it's single farmsteads, you know, they're physically separated from each other, one household per farmstead. And then when you get to a town, to Dublin, firstly in the our earliest urban houses are 860s, 870s, you know, the second quarter, third quarter of the 9th century. And you're going from these round houses, they're literally round houses in big enclosures, you know, with space around them, you know, that you can walk around all sides of them. And you're going into these very narrow rectangular properties where your neighbours are right here beside you. And you can't, you know, squeeze in between the houses. You know, it's very different patterns of space and very different arrangements. And instead of, you know, you stay, you know, I'm also speaking because I grew up on a farm on the top of the mountains, you know, the whole world is your playground. But does that change when you get into the urban environment, when there are neighbours everywhere and there's always people around you? Do you have more or less freedom as a child to be a child and to run and play and make up your own games?
I think that's one of the big challenges, though, you know, with this work, with looking at, you know, what's indicated from the historical literature as opposed to historical records from mm-hmm. Iceland, together with the material culture, is that there is an emphasis, at least from the child artifacts that we can get, or artifacts are identified as being a child material culture in the archaeological records from Norse Greenland. And that, you know, most of the dominance of material culture in Norse Greenland comes from these early 20th century excavations. So there is a degree of bias, and that we need to interpret, you know, what they interpreted with caution as well. And what I found is that there is a high degree of inconsistency in the interpretation of miniatures, especially miniature toys and sort of adult material culture that's seen as being a miniature or just seen as being a small example of, you know, a lamp. But the so there's a large degree of I suppose there is a large degree of interpretation involved in analysing those artifacts. And I almost think that in the context of towns, it would be really interesting to look at that rural urban transition, whether there is any difference in the use of material cultures. But I think there is some evidence of, you know, at least things like, so there was a recent paper by some researchers in Sweden who were looking at hegemonic masculinity. It's in archaeological blogs. You might have already seen it, but the they're looking at some of these examples of material culture and the emphasis, especially among generally elite male children, on the sort of warfare, very masculine emphasis. And it would be interesting, I think, to look at the transition, whether that's something that's generally rural, or do we see it across, you know, densely populated regions, such as where you're.
Yeah, it would be really interesting. And then I suppose what comes in there is the question of the identity of the rural population versus the urban population. You know, who comes to live in these towns? Is it, you know, are they invading Vikings, Vikings who have come to settle, to trade, or are they local people who come in to fill up this new market, this new environment, this new place? You know, who are they? And do they actually differ within the town from, you know, a mile outside the town versus 5 miles versus 10 miles?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, obviously, this, I think this is more your expertise than mine, really. But the because, of course, I'm looking at some of the probably the least densely populated parts of the sort of the Viking diaspora. But yeah, I do wonder how that would affect. I think certainly identity would be affected in some way. Not necessarily the sort of broader, maybe things like sort of hegemonic ideas of like identity and sort of Viking masculinism and different roles within society. But I think this is an area that really is understudied. And what I noted is that within the existing literatures, the focus on women and children is almost non-existent within North Atlantic archaeology. Obviously the sort of work with place names and texts, the work of like Judith Jess has been very, very, very influential. And there's more recently been an emphasis on looking at material culture in Iceland and Greenland, such as Michelle Hayer-Smith's work. Mm-hmm. She's looked at sort of the production of wool and different clothing, and how that differs, and how, you know, the economic role of women in Greenland and Iceland. But this has been, you know, it's an area that where there's an enormous amount to study, and you know, there are massive gaps simply because there hasn't been enough of a focus on those particular areas of the household economy and the hunting economy and the role of women in society as a whole and children in society as well. I think there is an important question. The question, sorry, that I don't think I quite touched upon properly was the question between, if you're looking at in Norse Greenland, you're looking at, you know, things like children might have been involved in aspects of animal rearing. So the elements of growing up would not just, of course, be indoors, but would also be, you know, about playing an active role within the wider economy. And I think in towns, the question would be, what is the role of children at that point? Are they involved in you know, aspects of trade, and do they get actively involved in those aspects of urban life? I'm not quite sure. Obviously, I don't study urban environments, but I think it's a really important question to be asked.
Yeah, it is. Not just children there, but also I think the role of mostly men, also women, differs because, you know, they're not maybe this is more relevant in the first kind of couple of generations of urban settlement, but men aren't, for one thing, they're not out on the farm tending their land all day long. They're not looking after the animals all day long. So what are they doing? You know, they do have to find other ways to fill their time, by making things. But, that market for things that you've made doesn't appear immediately. So there is this transition period of, when nobody quite knows what they're doing. And also from the very female perspective, if you have the man at home all day long under your feet, as we've all learned during the pandemic, the household structure changes. If everybody is at home all the time, rather than somebody going out to tend the fields for a couple of hours and then going back out to milk the cows. And what we see in the urban environment is, the kind of the bits of urban farming that do continue, the tending the kitchen garden, the chickens in the yard, they're kind of stereotypically female or children's jobs to do. Send the kids out to weed the vegetable patch or collect the eggs. So there is a big change in everybody's kind of roles in the household economy, in the structure, in everything when it comes to this urban lifestyle, urban way of life. And like I said, probably more relevant in the first couple of generations, and then things settle down, everyone gets used to it, it's the new normal. But it's something that I'm really curious about and really interested in trying to understand a bit more. There's been brilliant work done on the on medieval records, 13th, 14th, 15th century in England, going through the death records and the records of where accidents happened. And you can reconstruct that level of detail of where people were, cradle fires were a real problem, that you can't leave children under five on their own. But by that time, that knowledge is known. That's people know what to do, but there is this intermediate phase where everyone is understanding how to live in a town, how to change their ways of life to do that. And that's, I suppose as well, that comes under the kind of the heading of the landscape learning. I suppose you're learning the urban landscape.
Yeah.
And changing what you know, what you're used to, what your generations before you have done to this new lifestyle, this new environment.
I think it's a really interesting question. And one of the questions we were initially, at the beginning of my PhD, one of the questions and one of the approaches I was trying to apply, and I think this is also relevant in the context of landscape learning, is the idea of Tim Ingold's concept of taskscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And how you utilize, generally it's seen as sort of landscape approach, but of course the urban landscape as well, how that differs between rural environments, how different people experience, day-to-day life, seasonal life, their entire, how does it vary over their entire lives, their entire lifespans. I think these are important questions to be asked of their Viking settlements across the world, really.
And then what happens after the 13th century?
So from the 13th and 14th centuries, you've got still, from what we can see, of course, the climate records locally are always very difficult to interpret. There's a need for lots of computational modelling that I don't understand as to how you can try and refine at least some increased resolution around the climate at that point in time. But we do have proxy records in the form of fjord diatoms, which indicate the presence of sea ice from around the end of the 14th century, and certainly from the mid 14th century. There's increased volcanism around the world, culminating in the influence of the Lombok Mount Somalis eruption, which is likely to have, at least modelling suggests, it's likely to have reduced solar insulation to such an extent that in the East Greenland current you get increased sea ice delivery. And that would have had an impact on the local temperature if you have increased sea ice delivery, especially to the eastern settlement. The sea ice comes down the eastern Greenland current and is pushed up into the western settlement areas. So you're likely to have this presence in the summer months of increased sea ice, increased fjord ice. And that, of course, influences the local ecology. So you start to get these landscape scale changes in terms of the temperature. So as we discussed earlier, the influence of frozen ground and snowpack on the surrounding the environment surrounding farms. So the cultural environment changes, becomes less productive, it becomes generally cooler. And you also have a change in the ecology of the marine environment with ice riding seals and the decline of common seals that they would have known how to hunt from existing settlements where you get that in the rest of the North Atlantic and in Norway. So at this point, TEK, traditional ecological knowledge core, starts to become less well suited to utilising those resources efficiently. What we do see, though, from the isotope record, so from the bone collagen of from church burials, so Niels Linderup, Jette Arnborg in Copenhagen and National Museum of Denmark have done extensive analysis of these church burial records that we have, of course, from there, from exhuming the parts of the a few churchyards in the eastern settlement of Greenland. As they've done around, I think it's around 55, they've analysed 55 skeletons. And what they find is this transition from early settlement, where it is more of an emphasis on the domestic economy, and that has more of an influence on their diet. So you have dairy products dominate, or not necessarily dominating, but they're more dominant, right through to around, you know, to up to 80% marine dominance in dietary record. And that's corroborated in the zoo archaeological evidence as well, where we see more seal bones, a general decline in the amount of things like caribou and domestic livestock bones. So there's a general decline overall in the domestic economy. But the key point that we make in this paper is that they seek to maintain the domestic economy, even though it might be considered moving towards being a maladaptive strategy in subarctic Greenland. So the fact that they increase, the emphasis on marine resources to such a degree while maintaining that shows that cultural path dependence in the form, of course, of their Viking Age life way. They live around the household, as you've already said. They've developed these cultural landscapes, and they also have a continuity in all the artefacts we find, even the artefacts that are adapted to local resources, such as whalebone axe heads that match the iron axe heads that we've seen in the rest of the Viking world. There's a complete continuity despite it no longer being adapted to the local resources. So things start to become more difficult at this point in the demographic records that I mentioned earlier. The demographic models. Niels Linderup is suggesting a decline, and the decline is not associated with people dying, but people starting to move away from Greenland. And that's where the debate starts to become prevalent, because the debate in the end phase, there's no debate about it becoming harder. There's no doubt it would have become harder, because Walrus ivory is less in demand on European markets, because you have the opening up of eastern markets and elephant ivory. You have the increasing dominance of the Hanseatic League, who bring in stockfish trade and woolen trade and woolen goods. And you see that transition in Iceland, but there's no indication that the Norse adopted large-scale fishing. Because part of the issue is being able to find the fish bones within the archaeological record. Would they have been preserved or not? There's no evidence in the record. and also the movement inwards of the two late culture who arrive in this same core period, this colder period as they move southwards. Mm-hmm. So this has been suggested as a conjuncture from the 1400s onwards. So what we see from around the sort of, well, particularly the 1400s onwards, the late 14th and the early 15th century, is the climate record seems to suggest increasing storminess in the North Atlantic, and there's also a suggestion that there's increasing variation in climate from some of the work that my supervisor Andrew Duckmore, PhD supervisor Andrew Duckmore, did back in 2007. So it becomes more difficult to predict future climate, weather extremes, and then you also get this general cooling trend. At least we can suggest a general cooling trend. There are big arguments, of course, that go on about the Little Ice Age in the North Atlantic and, mm-hmm. and mainland Europe, and what that period's actually defined by. But it suggests that there's increasing sea ice, there's general cooling. And that will make things less productive. It means the marine economy becomes more important. But if population is also declining at the time, either because people are dying or because people are leaving, that would have an impact on the labour force, the available labour force. So the point we make in this paper is that the decline in the available labour would have implications for the communal hunting economy as well.
Mm.
So the efficiency is likely to decline at the same time in which it's becoming more difficult to access those marine resources. So the implications of that would be it's harder to access resources. The economy's in decline, so you're becoming increasingly isolated from Europe because the walrus ivory's no longer got such a pull. And eventually, in fact, historical records suggest that the trade boats that come in, there's supposed to be two trade boats, or at least it's been interpreted that two trade boats would come in from Norway each year to Greenland,
mm-hmm.
Cease in the late 14th century. So they're becoming increasingly isolated. And then on top of that, there is a new culture that the Icelandic annals at least suggest there's a degree of hostility with. So those are the sorts of three elements that have occupied debate in the last 10 to 15 years, especially since Jared Diamond's book. Because, you know, what role does climate play and how well do the Norse adapt to that? They adapted well early on, but could this have potentially led to the end of settlement, or could it have led to at least more vulnerable farms, those who are closer to the marine environment, switching off? We do see the abandonment of farms on the outer fjord, but the question is, are they relocating
mm-hmm.
further, you know, into the more sheltered conditions of the inner fjord environments? It's all very difficult to interpret with the picture that we have at present, but the relationship between those three strands is important, and if they come together at the same time, it's likely that they represent a conjuncture where the Norse will be hard pushed to adapt. So you've got uncertainty in the domestic economy at the same time as decline in the market economy, mm-hmm. which is further impacted potentially by the presence of a new culture that you're hostile with, which could also block access to resource spaces. You could think of them potentially camping on the outer fjords to utilize the marine resources at the same time. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that could also represent an opportunity for trade with them as well. But if you're becoming isolated from the European market economies, there isn't much to trade with.
Yeah, what have you got that they want?
Yeah, because we know that there was an emphasis on iron in the Dorset and the two late cultures. Mm-hmm. But from what we see of the Norse artefacts, there's a decline in the availability of iron. We see whalebone belt buckles.
Mm-hmm.
We see ivory pieces, and we also see in some cases some sort of strange artifacts that have been potentially even interpreted as whalebone padlocks, which is a bit of a weird one within in the Eastern Settlement, one of the larger farms has a sort of whalebone padlock, which is really strange. Yeah.
That's really bizarre.
It's disputed though whether it is a padlock, but it looks it looks a bit like one. Who knows what it is really? But
yeah. So I suppose you're talking, it's kind of a perfect storm of everything that could go wrong.
Yeah, so lots, I suppose in terms of pushing someone to the extreme, because it's the way we can think of it in terms of adaptive capacity is that the Norse have a high degree of adaptive capacity. And if you look at them in the early phase, it's well within their capacity to adapt to environmental change across the North Atlantic. So over space and through time. So as they move across, they can adapt their economy increasingly to new environments. As things are pushed a bit further and maybe the climate starts to cool or become a little less certain, they adapt even further by adopting marine mammals within their domestic economy and adjusting the balance of livestock. So you get that further change in the economy in Greenland. The question though is, when they're pushed even further, is it beyond their capacity at that point to respond adaptively? And that's where it becomes a challenge for, you know, you were talking earlier about one of your previous podcasts with someone who was looking at the 6th century in West Norway. And of course, that was a big challenge then. That's probably related to climate. And the question is how they adapt. I would be interested to hear how they adapted in
that was Ingar, and he talks about the differential vulnerabilities in different parts. That some parts of Norway were much more vulnerable to these climatic impacts than others, and that that there is that variation in that vulnerability there. But that some areas were more not necessarily physically but more environmentally remote, further removed from good quality soils, where you could grow barley, and that the change of a degree or two, the drop of a degree or two in temperature can have more of an impact in one area than in another. But where we are now in Greenland, you're so far removed, they're really already on the edges. You're talking about a reasonably well adapted population from the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th centuries, but it was reasonably well adapted to a very tough lifestyle. Anyway, they are literally on the edge, trying to cram everything into, 5 and a bit months of the year. And they're already vulnerable to that. And when that balance tips even more in the 14th and 15th century, it just becomes too far, too much.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, they are very large spaces that we're talking about, but because it's such a small population over those large spaces, the question doesn't necessarily become a similar question to that of Norway, where it's about different soil type, but it's, they're not cultivating anyway. They're just using hay fodder over the winter months. But the question becomes the difference in the available domestic economy and what you need to maintain that domestic economy. So switching on and off of farms. So larger farms have enormous surpluses. We see with Garda, the church farm or the cathedral farm in the Eastern Settlement. We see buyers that could accommodate in excess of 100 cattle over the winter months, whereas most farms might have one or two cattle. And it's more of a status symbol. So you also lose status in the process of losing the cattle, and you might potentially lose marital rights as well in the process, and has big implications. And I suppose this is what leads to the questions of why would people stay, and that's occupied a lot of the debate towards the end, is do they push themselves into a corner and succumb to perhaps famine or even conflict with the Thule culture, really, like a small population are finished off by conflict. Or do we get the population simply moving elsewhere in an unrecorded migration away? And this is what I did in some of my analysis in my PhD, mm-hmm. was to look at how that had been interpreted differently and how different forms of material evidence or the absence of material evidence has been has informed different theories as to what happens. There are two general camps, one that's more of an emphasis on famine, the other one which is more of an emphasis on migration.
Mm-hmm.
And the absence of, the absence of material culture in certain contexts, sort of like an elite artifact or historical records, has been seen as them leaving. The absence of bodies has also been a suggestion that there was no famine. But similarly, that sort of evidence has been interpreted in the opposite way as well. That in fact you're not going to find much elite material culture in this context anyway. That they weren't a very rich settlement area, or that there's a bias in the record that those elite groups might have left, and that you're left with a sort of a less mobile population. It's very speculative in that final phase, but I'd done different forms of analysis on why people might interpret different artifacts and different forms of data in different ways, and you get quite different results. And I suppose that's one of the challenges with the archaeological record and for making it relevant to the present day is what does the evidence tell you, especially if there's an active debate on what it means. Given context, I suppose in terms of the decline, I'd probably sit. I always sort of sit on the fence, but I think the most practical thing to say is that there probably were people who died. There probably were hard winter months that could have killed a fairly substantial portion of the population. People could have died out hunting in Greenland. But it's more than likely that they also migrated and took opportunities to migrate, which would have decreased the size of the population as well. But sadly, we can't really come to a clear conclusion on what happened in Greenland, because there is an absence of evidence.
There will never be a definitive answer to that.
So who knows? That's the question. But what I would say is the conclusion that we discuss in a few of these papers is that they reach the limits to adaptation, and that those are cultural limits. They're not deterministic limits where you run out of food and die. It's that there is either a conscious choice not to, embrace a fully nomadic existence, or to reject forms of the sort of domestic economy in Greenland. And of course, that's one of the things that we have to learn from today, is that there might be a high degree of adaptive capacity, but there's also a tolerance, a cultural and social tolerance to that capacity to adapt. That it might be within your adaptive toolkit to completely adapt to hunting economies. They showed that from setting up shealing stations, mm-hmm. various different points around the landscape in order to utilize those marine resources. But that ultimately, the fact that you have that continuity, you have that path dependency on fixed dwellings, domestic livestock, and a Christian sedentary culture, means that you're going to reach those adaptive limits at a certain point. And I think that's something we need to be wary of when we make calculations about adaptive capacity in the future, is how well do we think we'll adapt based upon what the data shows us now, compared to what happens when you actually start to reach the limits, the cultural limits of adaptive capacity. That's Greenland.
Yeah, in a nutshell. thank you. It's absolutely fascinating. It really is. And I think one of the things that I really admire is that it's been there's been so much collaborative research done. There are so many different teams working together on the Greenland data. It's great. It's doesn't always happen. It gives you so much more potential to work collaboratively, to have these big teams. You know, there's so many more ideas going around. There's so many more opportunities to follow up. So,
yeah, I think that's one of the testaments to NAVO, which is the North Atlantic Bicultural Organization, and associate collaborators working in the North Atlantic, is that it demonstrates how teams can work very well. You know, with different perspectives and discuss what that brings, and also to work between quite different international communities, different disciplines, and there was apparently from what I've heard there were challenges initially with the question of, you know, Icelandic archaeology and historical research back in, I think it was the 1970s and 80s, was still quite traditional in its focus, if that's the way that's what we call it. But they did it eventually. You know, there were some key advocates there who invited international collaboration in order to draw away that emphasis. And nationalism and key research traditions and sort of, I suppose, the path dependence of specific disciplines themselves in different geographical context has an influence on how we interpret the past. There are you sometimes get, I know this might be a bit controversial to say, but you often get quite high degrees of conservatism in places like Norway because they're so invested in, you know, their national identity is historic, is a sort of historical investment. So understanding the past is about understanding the national identity, but there is a feedback effect as well. What I consider is a feedback effect, which builds in that inertia in some respects in how you interpret the archaeological record and who you're prepared to invite in to also interpret those records. Of course, we get it everywhere. Get in the UK as well. But I think that's quite an interesting. I think that's an interesting area within itself, which is why earlier on I said I like the work of Alison Wiley and Catherine Lee, because they focus on how we do the sort of philosophy of archaeology, how we articulate the record, what's involved in interpretation and reinterpretation. So I think that's an area that we always have to keep in mind.
Definitely. I want to ask you one more question kind of about your Greenland research, and then we could kind of move on to the more general chat about the role of archaeology. Now, what's the one most important thing that you want to tell me about your research?
I think the most important thing I would say about my research and about any sort of future research in North Greenland is that bringing in sort of new ideas, at least into a given research environment or geographical context, can have quite an influence. At least I'd say it's quite influential in the way we interpret the archaeological record. And with this one, I was using niche construction theory, which it's an approach that talks about, you know, how the environment itself also has a bearing on adaptation. So in some ways you could think of it as somewhat deterministic, but it's also about acknowledging the agency of humans in changing their environments, which then changes the evolutionary pathway of animals and themselves as well. And I think it's a powerful idea because it starts to look at technology, environments, and culture as co-evolving together and having a significant influence. And it through using that lens, that for me invites a new perspective on path dependence, you know, tracing these changes through time. A lot of work has been done using niche construction theory to look at technological evolution using geometric morphometrics in sort of Paleolithic archaeology. And my supervisor in Denmark was in fact a sort of Paleolithic archaeologist onwards, looks at a range of different material cultures using geometric morphometrics and using this approach. And I find that really interesting in the context of Greenland. And I think that people need to I think what was most interesting for me was when you start to bring in new concepts, you can start to ask new questions, and you can start to re-articulate the archaeological record in a different way. And from, I suppose, bringing together a few of the things what I looked at during my research was that this hermeneutic cycle is quite important of interpretation and reinterpretation in archaeology. And that, you know, there were the debates back in the late 1980s and early 1990s about how, you know, post-processual archaeology and these constant cycles of interpretation simply mean that you can never know the past. But I think there's a quite healthy compromise where you can start to bring in new forms of interpretation, invite new ideas and invite debate, especially if you've got an open research community such as that in the North Atlantic, where you can start to ask new questions and you can start to reinterpret. So I think that's the thing. I suppose that's not necessarily something specific to Greenland, but I think it's something really excellent about archaeology is the questions we can ask of the past and the questions we can consistently ask by articulating different forms of evidence and reinterpreting them. But I suppose if you want one specific to Greenland, I think the what I found most interesting was the potential to look back at cultural artifacts, which I think have potentially been understudied in recent years. And there has been more of an environmental emphasis and an emphasis on diet, which of course is very important. But I think bring together cultural artifacts in the context of diet starts to allow us to articulate a really interesting understanding of things like social learning, cultural transmission, and starts to build a really interesting and sort of more perhaps holistic interpretation of the past, of society as a whole, and starting to look at children and the role of women in society, rather than just looking at what has sometimes been considered quite a masculine approach to archaeology, of looking at environment and the roles of men specifically.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. I keep saying it, but this is fascinating. I've really enjoyed doing these interviews because it's, I suppose, in a way, it's probably like, it's a bit, it sounds terrible, it's a bit like a Viva. I get to go in really deep into somebody's research and really think about it. It's really enjoyable, actually. So I had said that we could talk a little bit about kind of the general role of climate change in archaeology. We've touched on this a few times. Could you start by explaining what does global change research mean?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it can be a bit of a, I suppose it's a very broad category and includes
a
lot. But global change research, I suppose in the first sense, it's what it describes, which is just it's research that is looking at global scale changes, such as changing land use. Impact, the impacts of species decline and what's been termed the sixth mass extinction, as well as global climate change. So it sort of contains all of the research and all the research agendas that have been focused on that, whether it's in the work of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the work of conservationists. And I think it's sometimes important to think about global change research as opposed to global climate change. And there's often, I'm not trying to say there's too much emphasis on climate change because it's such a pertinent problem at present. But it sometimes is seen as one and the same. Climate change is seen as one and the same as species decline that's not associated with climate so much as direct human impact. So there's that, and then there's the question of where archaeology comes in, and archaeology can come in to various strands. And I sometimes think it's quite helpful to think of it, archaeological evidence in two different ways. Mm-hmm. So I think of discrete and continuous archaeological data. So the continuous is that has a continuity with today, so that it can tell us about the challenges we face today. So I think you mentioned in one of your earlier emails, DONOP, that distributed observational networks of the past. That's one of the papers I was involved in, where it's about how you articulate, using archaeological evidence, understanding of human environment interaction, but also human impacts on the environment and human perceptions of the environment, and what that can tell us today about contemporary environmental problems. One of the classic examples that it's one of the easiest ones to grasp, or I suppose it's still a bit complex, is the idea of shifting baseline syndrome. And you can think of that as very much having a continuity with the present day. The archaeology is uniquely placed to tell us about, you know, the fact that these baselines that we often set, so if we're looking at, you know, decline of cod in the North Atlantic, we might go back 50 or maybe a few hundred years with historical records, but that fails to recognise the commercialisation of fishing in the North Atlantic, and particularly the targeting of cod and herring going back to before AD 1000. And of course, archaeology and zooarchaeology can tell us a lot about the size of the cod and the scale of the catch, and potentially even aids, you know, modelling efforts to understand the impact that would have had on cod populations and the marine environments across the North Atlantic. So we were interested in highlighting that. And I think that's more tangible when we're thinking about archaeological evidence and what it can tell us, is that it can tell us about how we have impacted our environments in the long term, whether terrestrial or marine, and can start to hopefully help conservationists target healthy ecosystems, or at least set targets for reaching healthy ecosystems in the future. So, for example, if we think about marine protected areas, we could think about, you know, what does a healthy population look like, and how do we actually start to restore healthy marine environments? Equally for terrestrial environments, I've written a bit about soil erosion in Iceland, and you can start to understand the anatomy of erosion in and across Iceland from the beginning of the Viking occupation in the late 9th century. So I think there's an important role for archaeology to play, a role that they should have been playing for much longer in understanding the continuity of these environmental problems. Then there's the discrete example, which I think is more difficult, but probably has had more purchase, especially in the last 20 years, especially since Jared Diamond's work books like Sapiens. Where you can look at discrete examples of failure or success or failure in the archaeological and historical records. I think one of the challenges that we need to overcome, and what we've written a few papers recently that should be coming out soon, the group of us, is to try and get beyond the collapse narrative, because the problem with collapse, is that it occupies an existential fear that we have of the future, as opposed to something that's useful in trying to overcome environmental problems today. And this existential problem is what Mike Hume, who's a geographer at Cambridge, he's referred to this climate of fear about climate, and collapse fits within that. And especially Jared Diamond's deterministic narrative about the idea that environmental change of this type can lead to the collapse of societies. Now, I'm sure that the scale of problems that we have today can have an important, you know, very negative impact on societies, and potentially lead to what we might term collapse. But the whole mystification of collapse and what it even means is problematic for how archaeologists and historians say we have a relevance to solving these global challenges. Because it simply buys into a sort of widespread academic and media discourse around fear of the future. So what we've been saying is it's more important to focus on challenges of adaptation, and how can you use completed experiments of the past, the fact that we have hindsight and that we have empirical evidence from the past of adaptation to periods of environmental change, of acute environmental change. And what can that tell us about the concepts and their application, and also some of the lessons that we need to learn about the application of these concepts? And one example that I've been writing about recently is how we can interpret adaptation from using these long-term records. So if we think about how we interpret adaptation in the IPCC reports is very different to the way a biologist would interpret adaptation, which is the end result of, you know, end result of it, an attempt to adapt. So you are adapted retrospectively. Or, you know, if you use the IPCC report, it's very future oriented. It is a process of adaptation. But that for a policymaker leads to two very different outcomes. Do I want to be adaptive as an end result, or do I need to continuously maintain capacity? And I'd say you need to use both. I think you need to think of it in both respects of being able to look back and have a metric that says we are performing well, in order to be able to look forward and recognize what the challenges are ahead and what you need to adapt to. The same goes for vulnerability, where there's been a debate about vulnerability being considered a context to environmental impacts, or an impact of environmental change. And the likes of Karen O'Brien, very influential IPCC lead author, she has argued that it should be considered a context. So others have argued that it should be perhaps both. I'd say that it sort of needs, I mean, it is more of a context. It's a social context to an impact, that an archaeological, or at least a long-term record, will tell us that vulnerability changes over time as a result of the interplay of context and impacts. So we can start to look at theory, and we can start to inform how we look at, you know, what we should be looking for when we look at vulnerability to climate change, or if we start to look into consider in the future how well we, you know, how well we think different societies, communities will adapt to climate change. I think there's a key role in scenario development and working with other disciplines to start to work out what discrete evidence of environmental impacts can tell us about how we face that challenge in the future. So they're the sort of two ways that I've been thinking about it recently.
Yeah, there's just so much to think about there. And I suppose you're arguing that archaeology should take a much stronger role in these discussions, in discussions on change, because of the, I think you said earlier, because of that deep time perspective. And that's something that I really agree with. You know, we do have that long-term perspective, that chronology. So it's about ways of making that evident, of putting it forward. And it's in some ways, it's, you know, so in that social contract paper, you said that, you know, we need to publish in the relevant journals, which is absolutely true. And work transdisciplinarily, that's a word, isn't it? And interdisciplinary, and talk to everyone else who's working on the same issues. But also that you really expressed a really strong need for us to work with communities, with local communities, through museums, through exhibitions. And I think that's really, really important, actually. And the more I think about it, you know, because from our perspectives as early career academics, early career researchers with precarious contracts and, you know, the not necessarily the ongoing capacity to build continuous research profiles and portfolios, the idea of making these, trying to construct these smaller interventions through something like an outreach exhibition, an exhibition in a museum, is actually a really good way to do that.
I think that's that was something that, so when I was writing that paper, it was very much a response to the fact that the archaeologists that I was speaking to were saying, look, we're very relevant, people aren't reading this. And at first I thought, yeah, it's probably the, you know, it's probably the sort of gatekeeping of the, you know, people involved with the IPCC. But then I realized, no, they are interested in this, but the most visible forms of evidence for them are diamond-esque narratives, you know, the pieces that engage with collapse. And that really archaeologists and historians need to start to work together to together and with contemporary researchers to look for, you know, the relevance that they need to do their research, not with the aim of, not necessarily with a explicit aim of contributing to these debates, but that it needs to be perhaps part of that project, could be designed as being involved with practitioners, policymakers, global change researchers, and that they could then take that information, and that could be, that could have an influence in IPCC reports, in trying to establish a position in IPCC reports and set about the debate and you know, have a broad relevance to policy on global change. And then beyond that, also communicating to communities and to broader civil society through museums. And I think that's a really important role that archaeologists can play at the local scale, because people generally do show a strong willingness to get engaged with history, and that, you know, museums are trusted spaces of knowledge. People are raring to get back to museums after COVID. And I think, you know, in terms of, we want to address the challenge of this current pandemic, but beyond that, the big challenge is, of course, going to be global change, the biggest challenge of all. And in order to have convince people of, you know, or convince people of the challenge, and also to get them involved, we can use museums as something that archaeologists are either involved directly in or have at least a stake in trying to engage the general public, I think also in a dialogue, not just a one way, here's some information on global change, but archaeology is a tangible expression that allows them to see this and to reflect on it. And one of the examples I gave in the paper was an example from Moosgaw Museum, which is in Aarhus. At the time they had an exhibition on the Anthropocene, and the way the exhibition had been curated was in fact to use the artifacts as a way for people to express a dialogue with the Anthropocene, reflect on, you know, whether they believe that the Anthropocene is, you know, from 1950 onwards. Obviously there's still an active debate, but that's the sort of that's the sort of period that's become quite salient recently, but trying to engage visitors in expressing their view, expressing, you know, getting involved in a dialogue. And then through, of course, community archaeology, getting them involved in their local environments and in protecting cultural heritage locally, which will of course also be impacted by climate change.
Yeah, I know one thing that I've mentioned was that a lot of the climate change oriented research here in Ireland is very much on coastlines and coastal erosion, which is the most obvious form of impact. You know, you see a castle on the edge of a cliff and it's literally falling into the sea. You know, it's absolutely obvious. And, you know, and because it's a castle on a cliff in a local community, that's where the community gets involved and sees that. But we do need to think about a much wider sort of, you know, the much wider impact of climate change and all the other factors on our archaeology. Had I said that, you know, yes, I had, about the conservation of archaeology under our urban centres and, you know, the effects of flood, not reclamation works, but flood defence works, changing the water, local water table and so on, what impact that has on our archaeology. So it's, you know, that's trying to get that conversation going by engaging through museums is a really, might be the way forward, the way to do that. I do think, you know, that social contract paper is really valuable. It's really provides a template to work from. So,
oh, thanks. I hoped it would just be something that that archaeologists, you know, like a practical paper archaeologists can use to target their research as well. I think that was at the time the aim was to say, you know, if you're an archaeologist and you think you have relevant research that you can hopefully use, you know, the analysis, the bit of analysis in that paper to have impact, you know, impact in the current sort of research climate around global change.
It's really good, a really helpful paper, you know, to have somebody to again, though, it's your taking the bigger picture, the oversight, and that's your value in this, is that you do look for that bigger picture and try and find ways to pull the different elements together.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I'm glad you think it's I think it's useful. Yeah, I just hope archaeology can have an increased role in you know, the next few years, in the next IPCC report, perhaps a special report, and to really start to, you know, recognize history, archaeology, and cultural heritage as being essential culture, identity, and also understanding the sort of anatomy of the problem, global environmental change.
Yeah.